It's a great passage that we're going to look at. Many people might say, is that this story of a conversation that took place 2,000 years ago using archaic imagery, is that relevant to us today? And I hope as we look at it, we'll see that it is completely relevant to our culture and our lives today. The key verse, we're going to put the verses back up on the screen so we can look through this passage together. The key verse in the middle, verse 35, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry. Whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. And Jesus then goes on to explain, he's not talking about physical hunger and physical thirst, but about spiritual, psychological, emotional fulfillment in a relationship with God. Now, it's a great offer that he makes, that he provides for us. And I guess we live in a society in which we hear many offers, and we get cynical about adverts. We see something advertised, and it's not quite really what is advertised, particularly cynical possibly about the way that advertising has changed. Adverts these days don't so much talk about the features and benefits so much as evoking an emotional feeling. You think about the Christmas adverts of John Lewis and Marks and Spencer's. They tell you nothing about the stores. They just tell you a story that make you feel warm and fluffy, and you associate that with that particular store. It's a kind of a cynical manipulation. The shift in advertising style really kind of began in the 1970s with the classic Coca-Cola advert. Now, we're pretty much of an age here at the minute in this congregation where we will all remember the Coca-Cola advert from the 1970s. People standing on a hillside drinking Coca-Cola and singing, I'd like to teach the world to sing. Do you remember it? Now, think about what you pick up when you're watching that advert. Well, you pick up, first of all, it's taking place on a hillside. This is a spiritual event because hillsides are full of spiritual significance. Moses received the law on a hill. Jesus ascended to heaven from a hill. Elijah did that great miracle on a hill. Then you look around and you see that they're happy faces, fulfilled, happy, joyous, not got a care in the world. And then you look again and you see that they are different races, black, white, Chinese, Asian. Now, what has brought about this wonderful spiritual experience where people are happy and fulfilled and united in a family of love? Coca-Cola, a colored liquid full of sugar that rots your teeth and full of gas that gives you wind. So inevitably, of course, as we go on and go through life, we become cynical about what is offers that are made to us. So when Jesus says, I am the bread of life, whoever comes to me will never go hungry, whoever believes in me will never be thirsty, we're tempted to respond, yeah, heard that story before. But I think as we look through this passage together, and we'll go through it verse by verse, we'll see that Jesus' offer is different from the offer of the advertisers, which is, let's give you an emotional feeling and then see if you'll join in with us. Jesus addresses the mind as well as the emotions and the heart and the spirit. And there's lots for us to think about. Now, as Jan said when she introduced the reading, setting it in context, the beginning of chapter 6, they had Jesus had fed the 5,000, and they follow him because they want more food. They say, this is better than the Jerusalem McDonald's, I'll come along here. Now, the point is that they'd misunderstood what Jesus was offering. When Jesus looked at the 5,000, he didn't just see 5,000 empty stomachs, he saw 5,000 empty hearts. People were needing fulfillment, needing actually to find what they were created for, that is, to live in a relationship with God. Now, it's the same today. There is an emptiness in people's hearts today, an emptiness in people's lives. I was just reading last night Os Guinness's new book that he's publishing. Os Guinness says this, people today have too much to live with and too little to live for. Profound little statement. Part of that comes from the ideas that people have absorbed that actually there is no real purpose or meaning to life. We've got to somehow just get through and find something worthwhile for us to do because there is no fundamental purpose or meaning to life. Richard Dawkins is probably the most famous atheist today. I met him before he was famous. I was commissioned by a national magazine to do an interview with this up-and-coming author. This was just before he published Climbing Mount Improbable. And I interviewed him. I went along to his book launch. And at the end of the book, Climbing Mount Improbable, he tells a story in the book about when he was out one day with his daughter Juliet. She was 6 years old at the time. And he was out with her, and they saw the wild flowers. And he said to Juliet, his six-year-old daughter, he said, "Juliet, what do you think those flowers are here for?" And she said, "Two reasons, Daddy, to make the world pretty for us and to help bees to make honey for us." And Dawkins said in his book, "I was touched by this and sorry I had to tell her that it wasn't true." At the book launch, he extended it. He said, "Why are we here? Why is anything here? We're here for our DNA so that it can reproduce itself. It seems like a pointless point, and it is. There is no fundamental purpose to life." And so we absorb this idea that actually there is no real purpose to life. We've just got to have food and drink to get through in some way. Dawkins is expressing there the philosophy that's sometimes called nihilism, particularly advanced by Friedrich Nietzsche, the 19th century German philosopher, who classically said, "God is dead," that the idea of God is not to be respected today. And he said, if that's the case, we're, as it were, taking away the foundations of so much that's been built upon the idea of God. And one of those is the idea that we're here for a purpose. If there is no God, says Nietzsche, then there is no purpose. It can't be, because there's no purposer. No one created us for a purpose. Let me give you an illustration. I hope I've got one. Yes, I have. A pen. Okay, so here I have a pen. Now, if I ask you, what is the purpose of this pen? You'd say, well, it's to write. That's what it was made for. It's manufactured. Because it has a manufacturer who created it for a purpose, we can talk about the purpose of this pen. If I said to you that round the back of the church, there's some rubbish. No one's put it there for any reason. No one's assembled it. It's just blown there by accident, by chance. And I asked you the question, what is the purpose of that pile of rubbish? You'd say, well, that's a ridiculous question. It doesn't make sense. There is no purpose to it. It's just come about by chance, by accident. Now, what are we like? Are we like this pen created by God for purpose? Or are we like that pile of rubbish that's just kind of come together by accident for no reason? And if we absorb the idea that there is no God and we assume that God does not exist, and we begin to think about it, we then think, well, actually, there is no purpose to life. There can be no fulfillment. We've just got to get through, find our bread, find our drink, just survive in some way. Now, of course, Dawkins would say, but my life does have purpose. I find purposes. His purpose, initially in science, and now it seems in anti-theism, to oppose the views of Christians and other believers, he would say, I find purposes. He's moved to, philosophically, from nihilism to existentialism. The idea that we can create a purpose, create a meaning for our lives. Jean-Paul Sartre, the famous existentialist, said that we authenticate ourselves. We make ourselves authentic human beings by the choices that we make. We decide to do something with our lives. The point is, of course, that doing that, you're not finding the purpose for life. You're creating a purpose. You're imposing a meaning for life. The point is that that's hollow and dangerous. It's hollow. At the best, it's playing games, imagining that there is a purpose. But it's also dangerous because the things that we come up with, that we decide to do with our lives, can actually be dangerous and harmful. Supposing I say, well, I don't think this pen was made by a creator for anything. I'm not going to use it to write. I'm going to use it as a crowbar to lever up the floorboards. It would very soon break because it's not designed for that purpose. But that's what people do. We say, I will find something. I will do something. I will achieve something. Verse 28 and 29 in the passage. Verses 28 and 29. Let me read them to you. Oh, my glasses. They're up there. It's up on the screen. There we go. That's better, isn't it? I can go close to the screen and have a look. Okay. Then they asked, what must we do to do the works that God requires? And Jesus replied, the work of God is this, to believe in the one he sent. Then and today, people say, well, I'm going to do something to achieve something. And actually, our pride, our sense of we're going to do something, we're going to find our own fulfillment, can actually insulate us from what God offers. Jesus answered the question, what is the purpose of life, when it was asked to him? Well, it was asked slightly differently because they talk slightly differently, but they said, what's the greatest commandment? It's like saying, what's this pen for? What is the greatest commandment? And Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Just as this pen is created to write, so in the same way, according to Jesus, we're created to love. That's our purpose, to love. To love God and love other people. We're created for love. I'm a love machine. That's what my wife says anyway. But there you go. Now, We're designed to have God right in the center of our lives. And if we say, no, we won't, I'm going to do something else, I'm going to achieve this fulfillment myself, then actually we're on a road to disaster because we're designed to have God in the center of our lives. Now, my lovely wife is clearing out a whole lot of stuff at home, and it's amazing what you turn up. I found this clipping, which I took from a newspaper in 1989. Ooh. There we go, back in the last millennium. And it tells the story of a guy called Kevin Jenkins. Kevin from Barry, who drove a Ford Cortina. Now, what happens to him, I reckon, could probably only happen to a guy called Kevin from Barry in a Cortina. But there you go. Right. The trouble began when Mr. Jenkins and a friend tried to push start the Cortina on Tuesday night because the engine was damp. They pushed it onto a hill, but it gathered speed, and Mr. Jenkins was unable to reach the brake. He chased it down the hill for 200 yards as it careered into six parked cars. He then watched as it crossed a junction, smashed through some railings, and dropped 100 feet onto a railway line in front of a passenger train. The Cortina was pushed along for half a mile before toppling off onto another line, where it was hit by a coal train coming in the opposite direction. Yesterday, all that remained of the car was the ignition key, its number plates, and the cigar lighter. Police say they will be interviewing Mr. Jenkins about possible traffic offences. Now, why do I read that to you, apart from the fact that it appeals to our British sense of humour? I remember telling that, I've had that for a long time, I remember telling that in America. They couldn't understand at all what was funny. But anyway, but it appeals to our British sense of humour. Now, why is it? Well, because we're designed to have God in the center of our lives. And if we don't, if we say, no, I'm going to find my own fulfillment, I'm going to find my own purpose, then actually we're on the road to disaster. Back to the passage, verse 30. So having said, well, what must I do? I'm going to achieve something. I'm going to do it myself. Verse 30, they demand a sign. So they asked him, what sign then will you give that we may see it and believe you? What will you do then? Give us a sign. Again, people will reject the offer that Jesus gives of that fulfillment of living in a relationship with him and with other people by saying, I need a sign. I need to know. I need some proof. Funny how people say that, but when you actually challenge them, what proof do they need? They've not really thought about it. I was a university missioner for a number of years. I did 65 university and college missions and then needed half an hour to lie down in a darkened room. And I remember one that I did in Reading. Most of the stuff I used to do was in the form of debate. So I would debate with a professor of philosophy or professor, whoever was an atheist professor who would stand up and debate in a bear pit setting. And I remember being in the student union bar in Reading University, absolutely packed, standing room only, debating with this atheist and questions from the floor. And a student said, look, you know, I can't believe this unless you can prove that God exists. Can you prove that God exists? And I said, well, what evidence do you need? What proof do you need? And he'd not really thought about that. And I said, what would you need to do to know that God exists? He said, well, I suppose if God turned up, I believe. I said, well, imagine then a guy walks in at the back and he says, I am God. Would you believe him? Well, no, because he could be crazy. So what evidence would you need? Oh, well, he'd have to show that he's God, show that he could control nature. I said, well, do some miracles or something. Yeah, do that. And I said, would you believe him then? And he said, no, because he could be a trickster. He could be a magician just fooling us. And I said, well, what evidence would you need then? And he said, well, I suppose God is immortal. So if I found I couldn't kill him, then I would know that he was God. No, hang on a sec, because then he might be tricking me. No, supposing I kill him, and then he comes back to life again. I said, so that's your criteria for proof that God exists. God has to turn up on the scene, claim to be God, do some miracles, be killed, and then come back to life again. You are in luck. You are so fortunate, because it actually has already happened. And what we need to do is look at the evidence for ourselves and look at what Jesus said. Now, verse 36, see the response? But you have seen me, and still you do not believe. I think the trouble is, sometimes we find reasons to disbelieve. We find all sorts of reasons to disbelieve. We say, oh, it's not intellectually credible. Look, come along tonight, 6:30 tonight, hear Professor Paul Copan. These Highfield lectures are great opportunities to see actually the reasonableness of faith by academic experts. After this one, a few weeks' time, Professor John Lennox is coming to do a lecture at the university, Physics Lecture Theatre A, on the 4th of May in the evening, 7:30. Now, John Lennox is a great academic who's thought about these things, and like you're here tonight, some great gems to say, yeah, actually, this does make sense. John Lennox was asked once in a debate setting, said, don't you think that faith is just a fairy story for people who are scared of the dark? And in his inimitable style, John Lennox said, no, I don't think that faith is a fairy story for those who are scared of the dark, but I do think that atheism is a fairy story for those who are afraid of the light. People reject truth and reject Jesus because they find all sorts of other ways that they don't want to accept it. Let me take you back 2,500 years ago. 2,500 years ago, Plato, the Greek philosopher, writing his classic, The Republic. And in The Republic, he tells the story, the allegory of the cave. I don't know if any of you know it. It's there 2,500 years ago. He tells a story. He says, imagine people living in a cave, bound head and foot. All they see were shadows on a wall. All they ever heard were echoes of voices. Then they think that this is all there is. They become really absorbed in them. They have competitions. They give out prizes for those who can see the best shadows and hear the best echoes. One day, a man is taken out of the cave into the real world. There, for the first time, he sees the sunshine. He feels its warmth on his body, and he begins to experience the world above. Real life, real sounds, not just shadows and echoes. He comes back into the cave, and he tries to tell the others about it. He says there is a real world out there, a real life, not just shadows and echoes. The others in the cave, they laugh at him. They mock him. And, it says, remember this is written 400 years before Jesus, and, says Plato, they say, if they could lay hands on the man who was trying to set them free and lead them up, they would kill him. In the same way, as Plato talks about how people reacted to Jesus, people still kill Jesus in their hearts. Say, no, I don't want to believe this. I don't want to hear this idea that actually I can experience fulfillment by living in a relationship with God and a relationship with other people. But Jesus says, just begin to come to me. Verse 37, he says, get close to the screen again. All those the Father gives me will come to me. Whoever comes to me, I will never drive away. You may find it's difficult, or you know friends who find it difficult to believe what Jesus said, to understand it, to respond to it. Now, Jesus said, whoever comes to me, I will never drive away. Now, the Greek word for comes, the translated comes, it is actually, in some translations, it's translated as is coming to, which is a better translation. I only know a little Greek, and he runs a kebab shop in town. No, sir. But I only know a little Greek. But the Greek I do know. So, erkamenon, Erchomenon is the Greek word there for comes to. It's the present, it is coming, it's continual and gradual. And perhaps that's your response, or you've got friends who need to make that response also. That gradual stepping towards Jesus. Let me close by telling you of a story about a girl called Kate. True story. I met her when she was a student. She was an atheist. And I was doing a mission in her college, and she came to every single event I did, asked loads and loads of questions, and then asked if she could see me. And I said, yes, sure. I used to spend a lot of my time with students, talking with them individually. And she said, I'm really interested in what you're saying, but I'm like miles away. And I said, I suppose becoming a Christian is a bit like getting married, isn't it? You make that commitment. And you're nowhere near that stage. But are you perhaps at the stage where you could, as it were, get engaged to Jesus? And I said, no, I'm not at that stage. And I said, well, perhaps, are you ready to go out on a date, with Jesus? Are you ready to just make a first step? And she said, what would that mean? I said, well, deciding that you're going to spend some time reading the Bible. God will speak to you through his word. Read one of the Gospels, asking God to speak to you through his word. And she said, yeah, I guess I could do that. So I prayed with her that she would be able to take that little step. Whoever is coming to me, just take that little step. Yeah, like Richard said, of reading the Bible and praying, God, if you're there, will you speak to me through your word? She did that. This was in the days before email. I gave her my address. She wrote to me. We wrote to and fro for several years. And about 5 or 6 years later, she became a Christian. She came to faith. In fact, she came to work for me, and she's been on my team for 20 years, the longest-standing member of my team is Kate. And so the point is, it began with that very is coming, just that beginning step. So I hope that as we've looked through this, you'll say, yeah, this is just as relevant today, and it's relevant to my life. Am I going to take those first steps? I'm going to lead in a prayer. It's a prayer for someone who's saying, I'm not even ready to become a Christian, but I just want to take some steps forward. It's also a prayer. This is a bit of a sneaky prayer because it will work for someone like that, but it will also work if you are a Christian and you're thinking, I'm not actually experiencing that now myself. Now notice in the key verse, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry. He who believes in me will never be thirsty. That present tense. It's about as we continue to come to him, continue to believe in him, then we will find that fulfillment in our lives. It's not about, oh, I prayed a prayer back years and years ago. I've had my card stamped. Actually, no, I'm continuing to believe in Jesus. I'm continuing to trust him. So that's going to be my prayer. Let's pray that. God, thank you that you created us. Thank you for that story of Jesus talking about being the bread, that we need never be hungry or thirsty again. We can find that fulfillment in our whatever way is appropriate for us, Lord. May we just take those steps of getting closer to you. Perhaps for some of us, it's that first step. That first step, as it were, going out, spending time reading the Bible, praying. For some of us who've been Christians for some while, Lord, perhaps it's spending more time reading the Bible and praying. The reason we're not feeling fulfilled is because we're not continuing to come to you. Leave a moment of pause of silence for you just to reflect in your own mind about that. And then we're going to sing a hymn, a hymn which is ideal for this. It is the hymn, Speak, Lord, in the Stillness. So let's just have a moment of silence, and then if we could go straight into the hymn, Speak, Lord, in the Stillness.